podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Special Tour Live with me, a very special host, Rob Cummins, in the chair. With very
special... suppose the rubbish you get week in, week out.
I suppose the shite you get week in, week out. No, I've got the lovely not shite Neil Atkinson and a lovely not shite Sean Rogers. The reason this one's special is twofold. One, it's the last ever Tour Live for reasons I don't know and I don't care, but it is the last one. But it's also particularly special because it's a transfer gutter edition of Tour Live. And we're doing it on the day that the story is breaking that Liverpool seem to be on the verge of signing. And I'm going to start doing his song, actually, before I even say his name. Who put the ball in the blue shite net, Neil?
Is it Dominic? Say this.
Can you just Szoboszlai.
Dominic Szoboszlai.
I don't know if that scans, but Dominic Szoboszlai could be our next hero. What we know so far is that Liverpool... I'm not going to exactly say they've triggered his 70 million euro release clause, but it seems like they're doing something very close to triggering. I hope it's triggering. They seem to have all but agreed terms with the player himself. All the main patch journalists are saying this. I think the latest we have is that Liverpool aren't that likely to complete this deal today, but I think Leipzig and Liverpool are good mates, aren't they, quietly? So they're all doing it in their own good time, and hopefully this happens over the course of the next few days. Neil, what's your expectations on the progress of the deal at the moment?
I think it's going to happen. I think it'll happen relatively quickly. I think Liverpool and Leipzig have clearly come to an understanding. It's always in Leipzig's interest to show that they're open to getting players what they want, rather than just the idea of what Leipzig might want. The precise sort of nature of the release is, you know, I think that Liverpool will be working that one out. When I talked to Guido yesterday, and that feels like it was so long ago, his thing was, Liverpool will make, Jurgen Klopp and Liverpool will make a couple of phone calls and things will happen and get sorted. And I think that's just where we are. And I think it is happening and I think it is getting sorted. You've seen all the accelerations of the stories like we have in the past from all the trusted journalists over a set period of time. It follows in a number of ways the Konate playbook as well, in terms of what's broken where, when, a bit more from Germany, a bit more from Ornstein, and then the local journalists pick it up and go from there. That's what happened last time. It's what's happened this time. So I think that everything can go wrong. You've got to obviously caveat everything that you say until it's done, and you've seen him in the picture doing the lean and all that sort of stuff. But I think he's going to be playing for Liverpool next season. I'm really excited about it, in a way that when it was always being mooted as three lads who were all like boxers, I wasn't against that, but I was, you know, the idea of the 368s was a nice idea. But last summer I was saying they could have done with an attacking midfielder. This summer I've wanted them to get someone who looks like an attacking midfielder who they can turn into a slightly different footballer, which is what I think they will do. I'm into it big time. I really am. I've looked at some profile stuff, some data stuff. I've had more data stuff sent to me today by StatsBomb, which people can see if they download the app and subscribe. That's in there as well. It's really interesting. His defensive metrics versus other attacking midfielders are really strong. I think he's a really exciting prospect. He's only 22. He's got the number of games Liverpool like. I'm into it big time, Rob. I am into it big time.
Sean, are you into him big time?
Yes. Certainly much more so than Mount. I think that the biggest thing with the transfers is that it very much looks to me like Liverpool, as you'd expect, are going to be doing a fair bit of 3-2-2-3, or if you like, the 3-box-3 build-up that Liverpool have been looking at. But also, Arsenal and Manchester City defend in a 4-4-2 or a 4-2-4 a hell of a lot more, even though City and Arsenal use the similar shape, whereas we revert to a 4-3-3 to defend. I've wondered for a while that if you were a new manager coming into this squad and just had a look at the players, I don't think 4-3-3 would be the very first formation you would come to in terms of a conclusion. If you were saying, how do we get the best out of Mo Salah? Yeah, take Mo Salah out of the equation. I'm not sure 4-3-3 is where you come down to here. So I think there would be a bit more 4-4-2-ing and maybe a bit more flexibility this season than just that kind of a build-up. So you want to buy a footballer that can fit that build-up phase that Liverpool have been using towards the end of the season, but can also offer flexibility elsewhere. Now, Mount might have done that on the left-hand side, but on the right-hand side, that role requires you to get on the outside of Salah to occupy areas on the wide right. And at times, you can look more like a right-sided midfield player than a nominal central midfield player. And I think this player on the surface is much more suited to those areas of the pitch than Mount would be. And when you look at the overall package, I'd imagine it's probably not too dissimilar a package between the two.
I think it's interesting that we can now see, Neil, the shape of the type of Liverpool have been planning to buy for this summer. We saw, obviously, McAllister came in early, and we saw, and predominantly we see him as a left-sided number eight, I think, who can do other bits and pieces that we need to do. We've seen lots of links, ongoing links to the likes of Kone, Thuram most strongly. Who else am I thinking? Another defensive-ish left-sided pivot number, left-sided sixes, if you want to give a dog a name. We've also, more recently, seen lots of links to the likes of Barella, Vega, and now Dominic Szoboszlai, right-sided number eight. It feels to me we are buying for this box very, very clearly. We want two attacking number eights, and the dream that seems to be being fulfilled is it's McAllister and Szoboszlai, and we want two pivots who would ultimately be Thuram and Trent, I think, if things go according to plan.
I think eventually Thuram and Trent, I don't think that's get first game or anything like that. I think that's a growth thing over a period of time. And the other thing about it is it suits the asymmetrical nature. So whoever's going to play left-hand-sided left-back on paper is going to have to do some work at left-hand-sided centre-back. If you imagine the whole thing tilts, the right-back's becoming a central midfielder on the right-hand side. That means that you want the player in front of him to be higher, and Salah is our highest footballer most of the time we play football. Mm. If you imagine the whole thing, rather than thinking of it as a rectangle, you almost turn it a little bit so that it isn't, if you use diamonds in a football sense, people think you mean literally like the diamonds in the middle of the pitch. What I mean is if you it's a bit more of a rhomboid, you turn it a little bit where you've got your left-hand side of the fullback who's come a little bit deeper. Your left-hand side of midfielder needs to be able to, of the attacking midfielders, needs to be able to come a little bit deeper, which suits McAllister down to the ground and arguably suits Jones down to the ground as well, and maybe even come a little bit wider.
Does it bring Diaz inside a bit?
And then maybe that brings Diaz inside a bit, Salah up higher, Gakpo a little bit lower. Now, there's obviously question marks around Diaz for those of us who are thinking about it, but there is still, you know, the output's going to be a problem there and we need to get that out of him, and hopefully this will help that a little bit. But someone like Szoboszlai, having the higher player, the more 10-ish of the two attacking midfielders, be the one on the right-hand side, I think makes a ton of sense. And it's another reason why, you know, they do need to move past Henderson in that position, because it just doesn't suit him all-around skill set.
You spoke, I think, earlier...
We've got Dan on the telly. Go to Dan.
Oh, I keep forgetting about Dan. Dan, actually, yeah, Neil and... Oh, God, some apologies, Dan. It's been Hi, mate. It's been a long day. You're about to go off my telly as well. You're back.
I was happy just watching, you know, being a video watcher.
out of sight, out of mind. Look, seriously, Neil and I were having a quick chat in the office before we came down, and Neil had been talking to, I'm going to paraphrase everything you just said to me, Neil, about, you spoke to Rafa Honigstein,
yeah,
journalist Rafa Honigstein, and he was effusive about the player, but
loves the player,
had some doubts as to about how he fits into a Liverpool system, and without wanting to sort of take words out of his mouth here, I'm guessing he thinks he's not a robust, defensive-y, hyper-pressy kind of Wijnaldum, Henderson, Fabinho type of midfielder who he possibly thought we would be rebuying for. I just wonder if this more attacking morph, and that's not to decry the fact that Szoboszlai hasn't got a defensive game, but this more attacking morph of midfielder is part of an evolution into a Liverpool side and way of playing that's not a million miles off the way City play. In the sense, I suppose what I'm asking in a very long-winded way is, can you see Szoboszlai fitting into a similar role that Bernardo Silva has fulfilled at Man City?
Potentially. I actually think he's perfect in terms of profile because he has that rawness. And I think they've seen something that they probably wanted to work with and mould as well as, you know, the raw potential he has. So you take, you know, his long-distance shooting, for example. There's loads of that they'll want to encourage, but there's also loads of it they'll want to work on in terms of just carrying on the move or building the play a little bit more. And so, you know, I think it actually, you know, in some ways it's that kind of Wijnaldum-esque thing of knowing that there's plenty of, or Mane even, there's plenty of potential there with the player, but there's also a way in which you can see him working differently. And I think that will play into what Liverpool ultimately are trying to do. I agree with both Sean and Neil in terms of what they're trying to do in terms of both, you know, that sort of right-hand side and also a little bit further up the pitch. But I think this makes sense because I think they see a ceiling for the player that's a lot higher than what it currently is. And I think if they can structure the deal in a way in which, you know, they feel they're getting real value, then in that sense, you know, if they feel that this is potentially a £150 million player in 18 months, 2 years' time, then, you know, I think that's what they'll work towards. And they'll work towards, you know, structuring a deal which makes it look like they've got real value for him in terms of its outlay. So in terms of the Bernardo Silva thing, I'm not sure. I think there's other players in the squad, I think, who'd be more moulded to that. You know, I think the description of McAllister as a Swiss Army knife, I think that might be where he sort of gets used a little bit more.
But I mean, he's not a dribbler, McAllister. I suppose that's, you know, you look at Szoboszlai's clips, he opens.
I think he is a bit, I think McAllister is a bit of a dribbler. I think a little bit more so than people would give credit for.
Okay.
Just dead quick, I think that the reason why I'm really excited about this is that it's really, and again, it's not to be disrespectful to the players or anything like that. It's the obvious, I think it's the easiest, cleanest. You bring someone like this into play where Henderson's been playing, you get more out of everybody signing. I think it's the cleanest one of them. I think if you think about, for instance, Arsenal's business last summer with Zinchenko and Gabriel Jesus, it was the sort of business that didn't take a genius to work out, that give Arsenal a better left back and give Arsenal a better centre forward. They'll look like a better team. And this feels, you know, straight away to me. I think you can, Curtis is currently ripping it up for the under-21s. Listen, Alexis McAllister's just won the World Cup. But you can do a bit of, well, will you get that much more from McAllister than Curtis? And, you know, and Curtis is on a development path and all that sort of stuff. And maybe that's me overrating Curtis and people listening to that might think that. But what I mean more is, I don't think that sort of makes you go, bang, this can lift you 15%. I think Sean wants to get in. I think that this sort of footballer with this sort of ceiling into what we've been doing with Jordan, who I think has been, you know, doing well enough at it and doing well enough, the ugly stuff side of it, I think this sort of player into there makes me feel as though this is now a Liverpool side that can create more better chances and take more and better chances.
Completely. I was just going to say that I think Jordan Henderson was needed whilst they were putting this system into play, because you need some serious experienced players there. And to have your skipper in there on the pitch, helping to marshal that, someone who's experienced, if the system's not quite working, can drop in and do a bit of the nitty gritty stuff. But now you don't want to see him anywhere near that role, because A, not just the signing, but I think there's an argument against lower league opposition to play Cody Gakpo in them roles. You saw it against Southampton away, I think Villa at home, when he dropped into that kind of a role, the potential that he's got, that enables you to play a Jota or a Nunes as the nine against the lower league sides, I mean. But I think Harvey Elliott's really unlucky in that. I think if Curtis Jones starts the season playing in Harvey Elliott's role in the mess that was going on for the first two-thirds of the season, and then Curtis comes out and Harvey Elliott gets dropped into this system playing Henderson's role with that run of fixtures, I think, if you like, the scales of justice or the seesaw between Jones and Elliott would at least be level or maybe flip-flopped a bit. And I think one great thing that this signing does is it enables us to use Harvey Elliott in the way that I think he should be used, which is to wrap him up in a bit of cotton wool, drop him into the Europa games. And I think if Liverpool are going to use the 3-box-3 system, that right-hand side role where Henderson's been playing is made for Harvey Elliott, and whisper it. But even against Southampton, you see just how some of the play from him in that game doesn't get commented on because it's end of season game and it's Southampton and all the rest of it. But the potential for him to do that role well is still there. He's got to prove it. And I think this gives him more time and can give everyone more patience, because you've got an off-the-shelf player that you would think could hit the ground running.
Just on that as well, I think it's good for Doak. I think it's good for Gordon, because what it means is there's other options to cover for Salah. Liverpool don't have to, even if, you know, in even a year's time, maybe feel as though they need to go and buy someone to get in the way of that one. And all of it's well-timed with the Europa League stuff as well, you know, in terms of giving him a little, this player and anyone else who comes in, a little bit of time to settle if it's needed. I think if he's coming in at 60 million, I think Liverpool think he's playing a lot of football, number one. And number two, I think the footballer himself, he's got the number of games Liverpool like to feel as though he can kick on. He's got three seasons of scoring double figures in all comps. Liverpool like that sort of thing. Again, the idea of kicking on, a lot of ceiling talk, Rob. I genuinely, you know, with the release clause, if it all comes off, we're all going to look like idiots if it doesn't. I mean, the Anfield Rap's putting 5 interviews out today with different people for 10 minutes about him, so we're all going to look daft if it doesn't. But all the way through, and it's interesting when you do talk to other people and people who've got other perceptions of Liverpool. Like I did a thing a month ago where I said of him, this is the one I like. This is the one I think profiles brilliantly. Adding to that his physical stature, that he is 6'2". That stuff does matter. It's not crucial, but you don't want to be setting out a team of a series of footballers who are all 5'8". You can have a couple in there who are 5'8", but you want to feel as though you can deal with set pieces in this country and stuff like that as well. And having that blend matters. So it almost feels like a little bit of a no-brainer, and I'm glad Liverpool have it. And this is one of the reasons why I like it, as I said before, the Arsenal argument from last season, the idea that you can just look at it and go, well, if you make that better in a certain way, you'll be markedly better. And I think that's, you know, and Liverpool do finish the season quite strongly, don't get me wrong, playing this new system. And it also, I think it does to go back to your first question, it does answer that. I think the question as to what we're doing next season, are we continuing with this, yes or no?
I think we are. I wonder how much of this is an opportunity thing and a timing thing. It does remind me of a little bit of the Diaz deal in many ways of this has come about. I wouldn't be surprised if we've internally thought for a couple of months that he was going to Newcastle. They were just going to activate that release clause and the player was going to go there. It seems what's changed is he wasn't entirely keen on a move today. And I wonder, I do wonder whether our priorities were maybe elsewhere in the sense that we just maybe thought we couldn't get the deal over the line and then it's become an opportunity and we've pressed ahead with it. I do wonder what it does for the rest of the squad and for also, you know, the rest of the transfer window. I've just had a look. If we sign him, that's eight midfielders and it's not, you know, it's not players who you'd be happy being on the periphery playing 10 to 15 a season. You know, even someone like Bacetic, you'd want to get 20 appearances upwards next season. You know, that's eight midfielders. I think they still need to do a sort of forward thinking with the future in mind, number six, a Lavia or a Thuram. But I think to do that now, I think, it wouldn't surprise me if there's a big out, Rob, is what I'd say. And it wouldn't surprise me if there's a, you know, look at Fabinho maybe this summer.
Well, I think, Dan, Thiago's only got a year left on his deal. And we're being told that there is no desire to extend that. And I can see if an offer came in, might be from Saudi Arabia or wherever, that Thiago could be one to reduce your eight to a seven. I also think they will be mindful of the fact that, as you said, Fabinho could go. But even if he stays, Fabinho's minutes need managing, mainly because he's not showed he's played at his best level. Henderson, at 33 or thereabouts, has shown his minutes need managing. So, well, whereas I'd agree with you, we'll have eight, maybe nine by the time, let's say, hopefully Thuram comes in. I don't think it's a fully available nine. So I think it's a reasonable level. I also think there's juries out on people like Harvey Elliott.
Yeah, I agree. I'm totally on board with that. I think it is an interesting one because I think, yeah, if you go back to sort of 18, 19, for example, you think about that half a season of bedding players in, so that half a season of bedding Fabinho in that season. Where we switched to a 4-2-3-1 just to change the shape to enable other players to get used to the system that we want to play. I don't think it makes sense then to maybe bring a Thuram in, for example, and just lash him straight in. And I think also with that, if you've got Henderson as maybe one of your only other six options, then there's a reliability thing there, even though I think he's probably more suited to that role the older he gets. Thiago might be the one in terms of, you know, it won't guarantee it a huge sum of money in terms of a transfer income, but it'll, you know, be a big off the wages, you know, in terms of that.
I think that they're in a really good position. And again, I think this is where the Europa League's a bonus. I'd rather have Champions League football, of course, we all would. But I think the idea of being able to buy a project number six for at least the first 6 months or so, or at least till Christmas, and then see where he's up to, that footballer, whether it is Lavia, who's obviously the youngest of the linked players, but has been playing the position, or whether or not it's Gravenberch or Thuram, who'd have to have a positional move and a bit of a mould in there. Kone, to me, feels like he's the last cab off the rank and that he's already playing the position, but maybe he hasn't quite got the ceiling that they want. You get the impression if they'd have wanted to action Kone, they could have done already, and he's just limped off in the tournaments as well. But I wonder whether or not that it's one of that remaining list, and they've all got pros and cons to them. As I say, Thuram is a positional reboot, you know, in there. But what it does is it just means for 4 months, 5 months, you've got Fabinho, you've got Henderson, you know, you've got Bajcic as well, if you wanted to take that risk and have him around there for number six, and then you could be looking at someone else. But you've got a really easy path with that person. We're saying, oh, they're learning the role, but they've got 11, 12 games playing for Liverpool. They're on 14 appearances or comps. It's just that six of them can play in Europa League football. It doesn't feel mad to me that. And I think if they can do it this summer, I think as much as they can get done this summer now, because it does feel like a bit of a marker point, I feel as though there's something to embrace here about them looking at doing five and just saying, this is it, we're doing five. And then, you know, not that we're never going to do anyone and again and get into that pattern, but the idea of we're doing five, where one of the two defenders we do is going to be a bit of a longer-term project. One of the three midfielders is going to be a longer-term project. One's like this lad where he's not the finished article, he's got a high ceiling, and the other one's McAllister, who we still think's got room to develop, but he's 24 at this point. that's a lovely blend. And I think that if he can do that, then we end up coming out of this feeling like, yeah, that's been a good summer.
Now, before we go on to discuss the ramifications of this potential transfer anymore, you've got some inserts to do, I believe.
We have indeed, if you are enjoying Tour Live on the audio side of things. It is the last ever one. That's not to say there won't still be two free podcasts a week, one of which will be on a Friday. As we get close to the start of the season, we're going to start putting the Friday show out as a freebie going into next season. So week in, week out, the Friday show will be going out for free. Obviously, there's a bit of a gap between now and then, and we'll be putting some other bits and pieces out on a Friday, but I don't want anyone panicked, as often happens whenever we make change. Fair few changes going into next season in terms of the Anfield Wraps output. There was meant to be an email about it today detailing all of this, but then the madness has taken over and you've got to get swept along with it and all of that sort of stuff. So anyway, coming up, we've got Tony Padilla speaking to John Gibbons and Steve Martin talking to me about the Ann Williams Golf Day. If you are enjoying it as a podcast, it's going to flip over into those two now.
And it is John Gibbons for Tour Live, and I'm joined by a doctor, an author. Are you an author of fact books? I'm not sure if that is the right word. Writer.
No.
a fantastic book called Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them. It is Dr. Tony Padilla. Tony, welcome to the Anfield Wrap. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, John. It's a pleasure to be on. I'm a long-time subscriber, so this is I'm a bit fanboy now at this moment. So that's
we're going to talk about Liverpool. We're going to come on to talk about Liverpool. Liverpool comes up in the book, which was the bit I understood the best, I think it is fair to say. But before we get on to the Reds, if you could tell us, you know, in a minute or two, a little bit more about Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, why you wanted to do it, and what the book's about.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm a professional physicist, so the book is about literally, but I came to physics from maths, and the book's about mad numbers, like numbers that are so big that, you know, if you thought about them, your head would collapse into a black hole, that sort of thing. So it's really the interface of maths and physics and putting extreme numbers, like the biggest, most wild numbers you can think of, and try to bring them into like the physical world and, you know, and try to see what would happen. And there's some really quite crazy consequences when you start to try to do that. That's what the book's all about, really.
And how much of this, you know, is related to sort of what you're teaching and what you're learning, or how much of it is trying to, I guess, get people's interest, you know, people like me who are probably younger people than me, to be honest with you, you know, how much is it about, you know, getting people's, you know, interest going in physics and big numbers?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's like, so one of the stories that I tell in the book is that, you know, when I first went to uni and I got like zero on one of my first courseworks, and I was like, oh my God, how have I got zero? And because I did maths, and it was, I thought it was all right at maths, but it gives me this zero. And I was like, he just didn't like how I'd laid it out on the piece of paper. And I thought, oh my God, this is just unacceptable level of pedantry. You can't have this. So I realized then though, when even though I always love numbers, that, you know, I needed numbers to have a little bit more personality. And that's where physics came in for me. And so this is the idea of trying to push numbers and extreme numbers into the physical world. And you get all these crazy concepts. So I use them as a vehicle to explain stuff like black holes, which, you know, everybody's fascinated by what this idea, this thing out there in the universe that from which you can never escape. And, you know, and my own research is into that sort of area and stuff like cosmology and trying to understand how the universe evolves. And of course that naturally leads you to big numbers and the most extreme physics that you can imagine, you know, sort of like what happened at the moment of creation. What was that? Why is our universe sort of one of the most unlikely universes you could possibly imagine? All these mysteries that, you know, physicists, you know, people often think like scientists have all the answers, but they really don't. Actually, science is really about questions and think of what the questions are that can give you, you know, an advance into our understanding. And that's what the book tries to get across. And it uses numbers and extreme numbers as the vehicle for that.
So is there anything in particular? Do you research a book like this, or is this more just stuff that's going on, you know, in your head and day to day, not necessarily day to day, down the shops? No, but is this stuff that you picked up over years and you're teaching, you're learning, or is there anything in particular that you found out by researching this book that blew your head a bit as well?
So it's a bit of both, really. Like so some of this sort of historical stuff I talk about in the book, like, you know, about how, you know, there's a great physicist called Niels Bohr who also used to play football, right? So, you know, and his brother ended up playing for the Danish national team, but he also played professionally for a bit, but he got a bit distracted by physics. I think he was in goal and he was spending some time sort of leaning against the post thinking about a physics problem and accidentally let a goal in. But he went on to win a Nobel Prize, so he did all right in physics. But But yeah, it's one of the things I do is I also sort of been involved in making YouTube videos about numbers. And so, you know, the guy I make the videos with, he'll come, you know, can we talk about this number, like a Googleplex, which is a really crazily big number. And I try to think of ways in which I can get that across about how big it is. And one of the things I thought about there was that, you know, if you have a universe, which is this Googleplex meters across, or this vast, vast distance, if the universe was that big, then, you know, we'd have exact copies of ourselves existing in the universe. There'd be exact copy of me, an exact copy of you, exact copies of Mo Salah and Virgil van Dijk elsewhere in the universe. So these are the concepts that you can come up with when you start to think about big numbers, basically.
You say in the book that Liverpool Football Club and maths were joint passions. You mentioned sort of, you know, being 10 years old and those are the things that you sort of love the most. You know, how did they combine? Were you even more obsessed with league tables and things like that than the rest of us were?
Well, so obviously when I was a kid, the first thing I wanted to be was a footballer. I think we all did, right? And then you sort of slowly get that realization, I don't know, when you're about 12, 13, that it just isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
And but, you know, I played against Robbie Fowler when I was a kid. Like, so, you know, I had a bit of interaction. And I played in goal and he scored quite a lot against me. I think he might have scored 18 against me, which is a bit embarrassing. So I quickly realized I wasn't going to become a footballer. So the other thing I enjoyed was maths, basically. I enjoyed numbers. And, you know, I think somebody asked me recently, would I rather win a Nobel Prize or score a goal in the final of the Champions League for Liverpool? And, well, I get disappointed by saying I'd rather score a goal in the Champions League final for Liverpool. But it's in your heart, isn't it? I mean, I'd quite like to win a Nobel Prize, but, you know, I think both are unlikely.
There's a fantastic bit in the book where you talk about Liverpool going for this league title and they've won, you know, all these games on the bounce, but it's not quite there. And it matters so much to all of us that no one was quite willing to say, you know, it's definitely happened yet, even though logic suggested, you know, anyone looking at it from the outside, I think, well, Liverpool have won that league title. I know Rob Gutman was talking the other day on a podcast about, you know, completely ignoring the number of points we were kind of clear and focusing on the number of points we need. It's like, shit, we need 8 more points, you know, forget the fact that, you know, you could lose 10 in a row and sort of still get there. And we were all stressed out about it, but what I really liked was that, you know, when we're stressed, we all do different things, and you resorted to crunching the numbers to make yourself better. And not just you roped in Dan, who's an astrologer, I think you said, and got to basically work out the probabilities of Liverpool winning the league title.
Yeah, exactly. So I got my season ticket in 1990, but it was just after we last won the league. So you know, it's the worst possible time. Right? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I've been 30 years and I was like, couldn't believe, you know, obviously, you know how it was. And we were just sort of batting everybody. Well, not necessarily batting everybody, we were beating everybody. And you just couldn't believe it. You just thought something's going to have to go wrong. We've had so many false dawns. So as I said, my mate Dan, he's an astronomer, and he sometimes uses me season ticket when I can't go. And he was like, he was doing this, he had this simulation where he could simulate, you know, what was the chances of Liverpool winning the league? You know, he ran a million of these possible outcomes each time, and he'd update it. And, you know, basically just simulating all the possible games based on previous data, you know, the kind of things that actually, you know, sort of the bookies and all that will use to sort of work out their odds. Just doing all this. And then we were finding out, like, so when are we going to win the league? You know, and it was like, well, I think it's going to be Crystal Palace at home. It's probably the day that it's most likely going to happen and all this. And then are there any possibilities that we might not win? And I think out of a million simulations, I can't remember the number now, it's in the book, but I think there was 20 of those a million had City winning the league. And this was even when we were 20 points clear, so there was still the nightmare scenario.
I've heard it before. It's 19 Man City and one had Leicester, which I'd love to know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right.
19 Man City and one had Leicester.
There was 20 that we didn't win.
Which out of a million isn't bad. I just love the idea of you know, sitting in the ground and people getting a bit worried and you going, don't worry, my mate's an astronomer. He's random numbers. And you're like, what the fuck is this guy on about? But, you know, but he did predict COVID.
Yeah, well, so then, of course, COVID happened. So it sort of blew everything out of the water. Like, so we didn't know what was going to happen, did we? And But obviously, and this is one of the ideas I explore in the book, is that, you know, out of this million possibilities, you know, there was very few where Liverpool didn't win the league. So Liverpool not winning the league was a very unlikely universe. But our universe is way less likely than that, actually, in some of the things that we see in it. But actually, one of the consequences of that was the COVID happening was because, so as I said, I shared my season ticket a bit, and I actually didn't have the Crystal Palace game. I promised it to a mate, and all the simulations were saying, Palace is going to be the day. Palace is going to be the day. And then COVID happened. So I ended up buying this ticket off some dodgy site for, like, I don't know, but far too much money for Palace, because I thought, I have to go to that game. I can't miss that one. And then, of course, bloody COVID happens. And anyway, they just didn't give us any money back for that, because the game didn't even happen. There was nobody there. And we didn't win the league that day. It all sort of turned out a bit different, didn't it?
But they got over the line, you know.
They got over the line, yeah.
By hook or by crook. Does Mas give you certainty then? Is that something that you think sort of is there, or is it just, you know, for stuff like this? Is it almost just a bit of fun?
I mean, obviously that was just a bit of fun, but I mean, you know, as I read, even if somebody tells you that there's, like, you know, a 1 in 50,000 chance that Liverpool are going to win the league, because that's what the simulation shows, you know, that's you're gonna start panicking about that 1 in 50,000 chance, because it's not zero, right? Isn't it? But like I say, you know, even as a physicist, you sort of see this, the universe that we're in, and you see that all the unlikely coincidences that happen often that lead towards the existence of life, for example, and you're like, wow, this is so unlikely. This isn't how the universe should look, but it does look like this, and we don't understand it. So actually, it seems like unlikely things can happen and do happen, and trying to understand that. So when you start applying that to football, well, all hell can break loose. You can, you know, you nothing's certain.
Well, I mean, you mentioned before about unlikely events that make things happen, and this unlikely universe that we live in, and to break it down to numbers is sort of really interesting, but it just shows that, you know, if things are slightly different, or things change sort of slightly, then the world becomes a very different place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so we have this thing in our universe, which is like the sort of energy that's contained in empty space, and it's really tiny. You might think empty space doesn't have any energy, but it does, right? It's just little quantum fluctuations. Give it a little bit of energy, give it a little bit of weight, and actually, it's only a tiny amount, but it should be loads, and it should actually crush the universe so that literally it doesn't even extend as far as the end of your nose. So the fact that it doesn't do that is this massive mystery that nobody understands. And that's actually my main area of research, trying to understand why the universe extends beyond the end of your nose, that it actually extends all the way out to, you know, way beyond the galaxies.
Well, good luck with it. If you find out, let us know. We'll get you back on.
All right, well, then.
Yeah, I quite like the fact that even the smartest people in this country and the world don't know everything. I think there is something sort of quite reassuring about that. I feel smarter just having this chat, to be honest. But we'll see. People do want to buy the book. There's football stuff in there, but obviously there's loads and loads of stuff that isn't as well. But Tony's passion for Liverpool does manage to sneak in there, which I'm sure he's delighted about. As I said before, fantastic numbers and where to find them. A Cosmic Quest from Zero to Infinity. And I guess, Tony, available in all the usual places.
Yeah, so it comes out in paperback next week, actually. So, yeah, they've got it in Waterstones. Obviously, you can get it online in the usual places, certain outlets, which I don't want to mention necessarily, but you can get to there. But yeah, Waterstones, you should be able to find it in there.
Yeah, Dr. Tony Padilla as well, if you want to follow him on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, John. Lovely being on, actually. Love it. I listened to him Friday.
If you'd asked me at the beginning of the transfer window if, you know, to come up with a list of players that would fit the needs of Liverpool, I would have named McAllister, Kone, Caicedo, these type of players. And Szoboszlai is a different type of midfielder. So it's going to be really interesting to see what he does. But what I would say is that Leipzig have seen glimpses of his brilliance, but there's yet at least one, if not two, levels for him to go in terms of consistency, because he does some wonderful stuff on the ball, but hasn't been able to always be a factor in every single game.
Yep.
And I think if he'd been able to do that, then maybe already he'd be out of Liverpool's price range, who knows, but there is still that last 15 to 20%, that if you can get that out of him, he's going to be a really great player. At the moment, a lot of potential, skill, a lot of attributes that will appeal to Klopp, but they need to, he and they need to crank it up a little bit more, I think.
Joined by Steve Martin of the Anne Williams Golf Day, yearly event, huge yearly event in Liverpool for charity, entirely for charity. It's great to be joined by Steve. Steve, for people who might not have heard about it before, just give the background of the Anne Williams Golf Day, the how, the why, what is it that goes on and where?
This is our 11th year of the event. Myself, Sean, Andy and Gaz created the event on a Read All Over the Land fan, Liverpool fans forum. After Anne's passing and a fight for justice for Kevin, we felt it was right to try and acknowledge that fight in the best possible and the most respectful way we could. So we decided to put on a golf day for her. The first year, we had 28 players, second-hand trophies, boxes of balls as prizes, up to what we've got this year, which is just, I keep feeling like I'm saying it, but it's so humbling and amazing with what we've created. It's, lads have come together, friendships have been made, the community's been built, all in the name of what Anne done. It's, honestly, I can't tell you how proud I am of what we've created.
What you do every year is you take a different charity and you highlight, and you don't just, you raise money for that charity, obviously, but you also highlight and tell the story of that charity. You came on last year and we talked about the work that Inclusive Hub do. How were you able to help Inclusive Hub off the back of the golf day last year?
We give them just on £15,000 last year. That's after our expenses of the day. That the day's not cheap to put on with everything that goes into it. So when we donated that money to them, to say they were speechless was like an understatement. They just couldn't believe that our day with the people in attendance could raise that money with the help of our ambassadors, our supporters and everyone else, from whole sponsors, the people that don't the Just Giving page. Every penny that we raise goes to amazing people in our city doing amazing things. Last year meant personal to me because my son is autistic. He'd been to the Hub. That's how I found out about the Hub. I seen firsthand of what they do. And our money now has helped them build a new Hub. It's fed children through half-term, put on activities, do days out. To see our impact that that's had to them means a lot to me, but it also, it's in Anne's memory. Now, as brutal as this sounds, there's no Hillsborough fight no more. The court cases have gone. There's nothing. Anne's legacy now is helping people in our city and amazing charities do amazing things. And I spoke to Sarah about this and she was so happy that I acknowledged that.
The idea, Steve, of when you talk about Anne's legacy there, you know, Anne was very much, she was supported, but she, for a period of time, was in a position where she was one woman doing the very best that she could to get on top of this situation, to deal with the huge challenge, the huge barriers that were put in front of her and what it was that she wanted to achieve in the name of her son. There's something about this city, I think, where people do help each other, but also that stuff comes from, you know, it's interesting the charities you pick. You mentioned Inclusive Hub last year. We'll get onto this year's charity in a second. But you want to pick the smaller charities, don't you? They're the ones that you want to help. The ones who are trying to get by day by day. They're the charities that you want because that's the nature of, I think, the city to an extent, but also the nature of the cause that Anne fought as well.
It is. I think it's all down to grassroots and what you believe in. Obviously, mainstream charities doing amazing things, but the mainstream charities also have chief executives on a ridiculous amount of money to run that. Then you've got the day-to-day people who get up out of bed and try their best to support the people in their communities and whatever charity they support. And as four regular match-going scouts lads who are trying to do the best, we feel as a organisation to extend, because that's what we are now. We've grown that much. We try and run this professionally as we can. And our stance is we will never pick a mainstream charity because they don't need our money. The day-to-day people do. And this year's charity, to me, for a while I've loved every charity we've done, this one just ticks every box and more for us. Because I could have asked every person who attended our event, name a charity that you think they'll support next year, and nobody would have picked this.
So what is this year's charity?
It's a Cardle Lane Animals in Need, which are based in Melling, which is obviously just on the outskirts of Liverpool to an extent. They do everything from rehoming a hamster up to rehoming a horse. They support every animal that needs the help, from vet bills to rehoming to carers for a couple of months, whatever that animal needs, they will go up their day-to-day life trying never to put an animal down. Now, we all know animals aren't cheap, vet bills aren't cheap, so whatever we can raise this year is going to the perfect place for me. And as I say, asked Dan to not emphasise in the mainstream charity a card line. They're just, it's a bit, it makes me feel good. Oh, I was, and I can't say any more than that.
You can, I mean, yeah, I'm going to ask you to, unfortunately. You get, because, you know, this is, it is a charity that a lot of people don't know about. People may remember Carla's name if they're of a certain age because of her background and the way in which she wrote around Liverpool and things like that. But it is a charity that, it is a small charity that is run, as you say, it's run off, I think it's Spurrier's Lane in Melling. That's where it's run out of. It's not a big organisation, is it, by any stretch of the imagination?
No, and, you know, even trying to get an email off them to hardware, because they're four volunteers, you email them and they're waiting 3 or 4 days for an email to come back. But when we spoke to them, like, they thought it was a wind-up at first. Like, why us? Why have you picked us? You don't know anything about us. But because we don't know anything about you doesn't mean we don't see what you're doing. And that, to me, is our day as well. All these people get up day in, day out, trying to make best of what they can. It makes me feel good inside that we're in a position to do this now. And with our supporters and how our event's grown, we're in a very, very privileged position that we can do this now.
So with the event as it's grown and with the supporters that you've got, you know, this year, when is it this year?
It's Friday the 7th of July at Heighton and Prescott Golf Club. And once again, I need to talk about the golf club. They've been so, so understanding of what our day is. They probably do bend the rules, to be honest, the way the golf clubs are. But they know that our event is special and they're so privileged themselves to be able to host our event. The publicity we get, obviously, LFC TV come and cover it. The Echo do their bits and bobs doing this, talking about it, gives them a platform as well, and they're appreciated about that as well as we are, that we can host that a day there.
So you're doing it with them, and this year, how are you raising money? I know all entries are closed, to be absolutely crystal clear to everyone listening. All entries are closed.
It's not even closed. I make the same joke every year about it's hard to get the season ticket wait list than what it is to get on that event, and that's very much so now. We've got people travelling from Salt Lake City to play this year. We've had people wanting to play from Australia, and this isn't an exaggeration. People have seen our event and how it's grown now, and they want to be involved. And as organisers, we're very conscious of keeping it to the ethos of what we've built. Friendship has been made, the community has been built, and it's our day. As the four organisers, we enjoy the day just as much as the people who come and participate. Because, as I say, to put an event on an man's name as organisers, it's very, very humbling. And it's, as I say, I sound like I big it up, but I'm at the position now where I'm proud to big it up. Because we've built this from second-hand trophies to balls to what we're going to put in front of our players and people and family this year. And honestly, it's just off the scale. It really is.
So when the money you're expecting to raise the same amount or even more this year for Carla Lane than you did for Inclusive Hub last year, you don't have to say too much now because you haven't had the day yet, but you're optimistic of that with the people's generosity.
I am, but I'll be honest with you, I think the figure at the end of it is a bonus because it's more than what they had the day before the event was put on. The fact that each year our event gets bigger, not in attendances, but certainly in stature for the supporters that we've had come on board, I'm confident that we will beat last year's total. Now, that's down to the prizes that we've got on the auction table and also the prizes that are going to go in the raffle. Each prize has been donated. We never spend money on anything apart from getting the tops framed, which we know we'll make the money back through the auction and raffle and stuff. All our prizes are donated. So sometimes we go to places asking for items and they say, well, we can give you this at cost. Well, no, it's a charity event. We're in no position to be buying prizes. So every prize that we put on the table has been donated. And the level of prizes that we've got, honestly, it's just the people in the room are going to be shocked.
Steve, can you just name your other? You've mentioned a couple of times that you're one of four. Can you name the other three for us? Just the steps of the show.
Gaz, Andy, and Sean. As the four, the event doesn't happen without the four of us. We all have our roles. We all do our thing. Andy and Gaz call me the boss. I'm not the boss because we just all do it together. Sean does his thing on Twitter through the donations, the Goods Given page. Gaz is the member of the golf course. He deals with the course on a day-to-day basis of what we need. And Andy's the scoreman. Andy's probably got the most important job because if he doesn't matter the scores, right, no one wins the prizes. And then I say, as a four, we get up on stage, we do our thing. Ben Burke's playing for us this year at entertainment. Ben played his debut last year, trying to follow Jamie because obviously Jamie Webster's gone above and beyond what he's going to do outside the P&M in the next couple of days. His ship sailed. He's gone beyond us, which we're so happy for him. He's our mate and we're delighted for him. But now Ben's come on. Ben last year was just so, so good. Trying to fill in for Jamie can't have been easy. And to say he smashed out the park, it was very, very nice to see. And everyone enjoyed him. So he's back this year to do his thing. And he's a very, very talented lad as well.
Excellent stuff. We'll run through it one more time, and you can find it on social media. I'll just give you the Twitter handle for now, but there's on Facebook and all the other places as well. Anne Williams, G-O-2. G-O-O-O is the letter, not the number 2. Anne Williams, G-O-2. It's on there all the way through. There's the Just Giving that gets highlighted on there as well. And if you do want to donate through that, you are able to do so, knowing where it will go to and how it will end up there. As ever, Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure. Another fantastic year. You're going to nail it. Is the weather going to be kind?
I'll be honest with you, like a thunder and lightning, I don't care. It's the day speaks for itself, and even if it does a little bit of rain, you'll throw a brolly up and crack on because you're there for the day. And, you know, people make the joke about when they go to the football gets in the way of a good day. Probably the round of golf does for some people. You know, it's... The prizes are amazing, the winners will be looked after, but to actually just participate in the day is all that matters. You're there for a special day for a special lady.
Thank you very much.
But we're back, and we're back with Rob, and it was 23-35 for those on their golden goal. Andy's got it at 20-33, and he is the final adjudicator. Go on, Rob.
Time stood still. And I'm back. What I'd like to get stuck into in this, well, first part of this second part, is what this tells us about... This, look, I'll rewind actually a bit. The eternal discussion this week, all over social media, Liverpool social media, has been about Liverpool's ambition, because we've seen our rivals, Sean, getting over the line or thereabouts. Arsenal with Declan Rice and Havertz has caused a lot of trauma in our fan base, it appears. United have all but done Mount. Spurs have done Madison. I think Newcastle have all but done Tonali. There's quite a lot of deals reaching fruition now. Liverpool, a lot of us, I think, have parked the fact that we did have McAllister in the bag before anybody else did. But however you judge it, whether you're worried about how much Liverpool will spend this summer or you're chilled about it, I think we've got to be unified in the fact of one fact is, if we're getting this one over the line, it feels like we're very, very close to, it brings a lot of relief, I think, to all sections of the fan base.
Well, buying okay to decent players for silly amounts of money. I'm not sure why people are bothered about some of them signings.
Our rivals are us.
Rivals, not us. I think our business has been fantastic. Look, I'm happy to get pelters on this. I'm always a bit more optimistic on, say, your Gomez's, your Elliott's and your FSG's than most. That doesn't mean I'm all in on all three, by the way. Nowadays, it has to be black or white, doesn't it? And no one's allowed any shades of grey on things. My view on it is, it seems quite clear to me that Liverpool have gone, look, we need 4 or 5 players, and Klopp has gone, there's a number of systems I want to play, and I need players that can do these roles. So if you imagine the stats bomb graphics that Neil quite often uses, and you compare players with each other, I think Klopp's gone, look, I need 5 of these. And it might well be that across the world, there are players in a certain age bracket where there's literally tiny pieces of paper between them that pretty much they touch most of the boxes. And if you want to make it in simple terms, they might range from 7.5 out of 10 to 9. And I think what Liverpool have had to do is go, right, we go to all those potential targets, see who's either keen on coming to us or is open to coming to us, and we need to pitch for it, understand the deal, who else is in for them, release clauses, what kind of package are we looking at? Because what you don't want to do is, if Klopp says, I want 5, and you pay 15, 20 mil more on the first 2, A, you've got a problem on the last 3. And if I was Mike Gordon, which we said on another show, there seems to be no middle ground in this market. You're either getting what looks like a bargain, like McAllister, or you're overpaying, no matter how good the player might be. And you wonder whether when a few of these dominoes start to fall, you don't want to do your business early and then regret it because there were players higher on your list that are then attainable. So I think Liverpool have done quite a good job, I think, of going to loads of players and getting them to be pretty much nailed on us. And Liverpool have just strung them along, have been quite ruthless, just to check what's going on in the marketplace for me. So I've not been nervous about it whatsoever. The time to judge it is at the end of the summer. I suspect you'll see Liverpool sign 4 or 5, no doubt. And they'll obviously have a budget that they've got to spread. I don't think this is a summer where they've got, we need that player. It's not about that. I think they go, we need a player with these metrics. And it might be that there's 7 of them in Europe in the right age category that they want to get. And for me, there's full confidence in my view it'll happen, not just... Forget the sporting director for now. I always say this. A lot of people at Liverpool, like Fallows, Hunter, people like this, are highly underrated. You combine Klopp and Mike Gordon. Mike Gordon's the key. Him being back there, for me, makes an enormous difference in all of this.
Dan, I mean, there's been a lot of scepticism that Liverpool would get anywhere near the spending levels of our rivals. But if we bring in Szoboszlai at the reported release clause level of £60 million, and we've got McAllister, and that's it's virtually £100 million spent already, and they're clearly not done. We were told, I suppose, about Feb March time that Liverpool might spend £200 million to reboot, given the traumas on the pitch on the past season. Do you think Liverpool are going to end up spending the big number, not hit £200 million, but where do you expect it to end? Because people are concerned by this number.
I think they'll want deals on their terms, and you know they're shrewd in that sense. I think they've taken the mick a little bit in that sense, to be totally honest, with certain deals they've got over the line that have been outrageous, and they've had no right to get certain deals done the way they have over the years structurally, and I think this will be the case again. So I think your final number, Rob, I think, you know, it will ultimately, I think everyone will speculate about it, but it'll probably make liars out of all of us. I think with this, so for instance, with this deal, I think Liverpool will be happy for it to go past this deadline of the release clause, provided that they've got an agreement with Leipzig that, yeah, the total figure will amount to what the release clause is, but we'll do it on our terms, on our structure, in terms of our payments. And, you know, if they can agree on that. I've seen a big thing with the Declan Rice deal, that it all come, you know, Arsenal wanted it heavily structured and West Ham weren't having it, and it looks like Arsenal have relented on that a little bit. I think Liverpool stick to their guns, and I think someone mentioned it before, I think the relationship with Leipzig will help that. I do think Fabio Carvalho going there will have opened up a dialogue further to what they've already got established.
Yeah.
And so I think that has to make sense for the rest of these deals too. I think the big thing for Liverpool this summer has been, and it maybe comes back to what I said before about shifting one more big name, has been getting the wage bill down. You know, I think one of the things that people never talk about when they look at Liverpool's outlay and their spend is how high they are in terms of their wage bill across the league and across Europe. It's absolutely huge, and it's huge in terms of fees to agents too. So I think getting, you know, 4, 5, 6 first team players off the decks to clear that wage bill a little bit to then build that back up, I think is huge. And the other thing I'd say about this deal is, you know, what we're hearing a lot is that, you know, the player was hugely excited and is hugely excited about the prospect of coming to Liverpool, coming to work with Jürgen Klopp, you know, turning down Newcastle and their project for that. Now, you can say Liverpool's a bigger club than Newcastle historically and in terms of recent success as well. And, you know, they're the sort of new money in town. But ultimately, I think we've all got a little bit down. You know, we've all sort of hit a bit of a funk in this kitchen party of Liverpool since Jürgen Klopp came in. And I think, you know, I think this needs to give us all a bit of a shot in the arm that this is a place that people want to come and play football still. You know, this is a place that people want to come and experience. This is the place where top players in Europe, despite no Champions League football, which we all thought was going to be catastrophic, still want to come and experience for themselves and play the trade. And we need to get back on that bus ourselves, you know, collectively. I don't dismiss anyone who has ownership gripes and stuff like that. But the thing that got us to this party was Jürgen Klopp and this feeling of, you know, we're the place to be, we're the place where it can happen.
The massive part of that, let's be clear about this, there isn't another team in the division, certainly who qualified for Europe last season, who wouldn't have had Alexis McAllister for £35 million. He's got his literal pick of the clubs, his literal pick. He'd be an asset to Manchester United. He's actually exactly what United could do with. In a number of ways, look at what's happening with City. They could do with another one of those types of footballers. He'd fit in there. You know, you can go on. Now, it might be that Liverpool wanted him more than a couple of other people as well, and were prepared to put more money down in terms of personal terms or agent fees or something like that. But any one of the top six would have wanted McAllister. This lad, you know, you feel as though there's a fair bit of demand there. You know, you've got to be careful when you're talking about figures, but what I'm expecting them to do is still do two more minimum. And I'm expecting, therefore, they'll do the two more, and then there might be a fifth that's off the basis of what the outgoings are after the next two, how the deals they manage to cut for the next two, what the outgoings are off the back after the next two, where that puts them, what that gives them the leeway for. And it may well be that they're happier to go for maybe a slightly more experienced option. You know, John talked today on an interview that's behind the paywall to Christian Falk, who says who's adamant in Germany the Pavard thing's not finished. And I just sort of wondered if that's one where Liverpool might do that at the end of the window. Can we make the money work on the 15th of August when everything else is done? Do we all look at what's there and go, yeah, all right, we can make that work for fees and wages. It's worth doing. And I'm just using that as an example. There might be another one of them. I'm expecting them to do one more midfielder. I'm expecting them to do one of the left-hand side of centre-halves slash left-backs they keep being linked to. But then if they do that, there's an immediate move where it either opens up, as Dan was saying before, the idea of one of the other established centre midfielders moving on possibly for decent money and going off the wage bill, or the idea of Shimikas moving on if they have done another left-hand sided player. And then it might be that, you know, if they then get someone else in who might play right-hand sided centre-back to cover Konate, then you're looking at being able to say to Joel, listen, Joel, here's five clubs. You're a Liverpool legend. You take your pick. We mostly just want you off the wage bill. There's a nominal fee of about £5 million, but we can make all of our bits work because we're bringing someone else in. That's the way I think they're doing it, Rob. That's the way I think they're measuring it all through. I expect them to do four, clear some decks, and then maybe do one more.
I think we're beginning to see some of the shape of the reasons why Liverpool walked away from the Bellingham deal. And I'll caveat that by saying they may have had no choice in terms of walking away because the lad simply said, nah, I'm not having you, I'm having Real Madrid, you're not even anywhere near the Champions League. But even notwithstanding that, Liverpool's language when they briefed they were walking away from the Bellingham deal in, what was it, March, April, was that it increasingly made less and less sense. And I do think if you look at, okay, the headline price on the Bellingham deal wasn't 120, 130 million that it had been publicised, it might be. But I think with the agents' fees, et cetera, coming into it, it probably does work out something not far off that. I do think, Sean, there's a question here somewhere on the line, but you do wonder, had we got that deal over the line, and cock-a-hoop as we'd have been as fans to have got that, you'd have then gone, okay, who else can we get? And given the kind of budgets we perceive we have, I don't think it's many more. Neil's talking about us getting a minimum of five, and I totally agree with that. But there's quite a reasonable possibility.
A minimum of four with a likely five is what I'm saying. I don't want anyone to quote minimum of five. A minimum of four with a likely five.
Yes, sorry, misquoted you. Minimum of four. So three midfielders and a defender is, I think, the minimum everybody expects to happen now. It could be five. I do wonder, had we been successful getting Bellingham, coup as that would have been, we might have only got another couple in. That, in a sense, the Liverpool statement about it not making increasing less and less sense, makes more sense, because it was clear as the season went on, we needed a body count in here.
Yeah, totally. I think you look at Wolves away, Brighton away,
Brentford away.
Yeah, look, the last half hour against Real Madrid at home, that was a Liverpool side that had given up. And I don't mean giving up on that game. I mean, their attitude was as bad as any Liverpool team I've ever seen. Like, I mean, I'm going back to Souness years. Like, the attitude in that last 25 minutes was unacceptable in a Liverpool shirt. So I wasn't sure how you're coming back from that. So you have to credit the management team for the new system, getting the players back. The players go along with that. Obviously, the new Trent role and everything else that goes with that. But whilst that's going on, he's number one going, Christ, I don't know how many of these I want in next year. Two, he's thinking, we need quicker and more major surgery than maybe any of us had actually planned for. And I think also a couple of the young players, I think he's gone, if things were really pairing,
yeah,
we can drop them in. It's too much a weight for their shoulders right now. And I think on that basis, you have to go, well, okay, like I was saying before, I need four or five bodies that have these metrics. I don't think he even needs to ask Mike Gordon if he can have Jude Bellingham and four or five of them metrics anyway. And like you say, chicken and egg, do Liverpool make that decision first, or does Jude Bellingham start going, actually, Real Madrid is a bit of a bigger fancy for me. And the other thing with Liverpool to consider as well, budget-wise, is, you know, Liverpool's wages have never been that awesome. But what Liverpool do is they treat the players like shareholders. So when Liverpool are successful, they get wedged up, and they get seriously wedged up. So when people go, where's the money? Well, the money goes back to the players when they're successful. Well, there ain't much going back to them after last year, yeah? So ultimately, you knock a couple of heavy hitters off the wage bill. And when you think that the bonus payments are going to be the same, you know, basically a zero, I suspect, for the majority, there's room for them to potentially speculate a little bit in that regard. And I get the people that are like, well, they should gamble against future revenues and do more. But you just couldn't do Bellingham and four or five in Liverpool's situation. And unless you're having a massive change of ownership, you've just got to... Unfortunately, we were in a mess. You can't do Bellingham and what the surgery we need at that point.
Dan, just getting back onto the player who we're most excited about today, Dominic Szoboszlai. and his effect on Liverpool's immediate, short-term and medium-term future. I've been looking at his heat maps to try and understand exactly where he plays on a football pitch, and I noticed there's a contrast. If you look at him between, say, 2017 and 2021, he's quite left-sided. By last season, he's very much established as a right-sided player. And we're seeing him, and I'm not sure the exact balance is, as a right-sided number eight, but also as a right winger. Do you think, and he's got pace, by the way, he's got pace to burn it. Do you think in some senses he's a solution for now, but also part of a long-term succession planning around Mohamed Salah's position?
I don't know, to be honest. Salah's such a unique player, isn't he? And you know, the thing with Salah is his ability to burst. And I don't think there's anyone in the squad like that who's got that sort of immediate turn of pace. Even now, you know, 32 or whatever, he still looks like he's rapid over 10 yards. But, you know, you don't know how much, as we spoke about before, we're maybe trying to move away from that. I think the question of width down Liverpool's right side next season's incredibly intriguing in general. You know, we're still not entirely sure what the role of Trent will be, and whether that'll change, whether that'll become more sort of hybrid for certain games or they'll want to commit to something. So the idea of where Liverpool get their width down that right-hand side might be a huge, you know, a huge detail in this signing. And he looks really comfortable, touch lines. You know, he looks really comfortable in terms of players closing him down. He looks quite press resistant. He looks like he loves a mag. Like he loves putting it through people's legs.
A bit like yourself, Dan.
There's one for the analysts. I'm available if you need me. So, you know, that idea of you know, him being comfortable quite wide, he likes crossing. Again, that's maybe something we'll work with on him in terms of, you know, maybe just picking his moments a little bit more with that, but he's really high percentile for crossing. I think Liverpool will be doing a lot of work with him going the other way. Neil touched on his defensive metrics before, but I think, you know, the concept of recovery runs and being constantly on the cover in this Liverpool team is something really, really, really important to the manager. And I think it's something we got horribly wrong last season. You know, the amount of times last season when the ball broke down and players were not just a yard, but, you know, 5 or 8 yards away from where they needed to be. I think that's something that spooked them really badly. And I think it's something they'll want to get back to. And I think he's got, as I said before, I think there's a lot of raw ability with him. But I think they see a lot of things they like and a lot of things that they think, you know, doesn't need a lot of switching, but, you know, things that they'll work with over the pre-season, over the first few months of the season, that I think they'll be really, really excited about. And I think Neil's point about height's bang on as well, because I think that presence, you know, Liverpool don't half hang a lot of balls up. I'm not just talking corners and stuff, but they're really, you know, they've been really adept throughout the years at getting to the byline, you know, just making sure that they can get a ball to the back post. And that's where Jota's been so successful, if, for example, as a Liverpool player, that he finds those angles. Think of some of Cody Gakpo's goals since he's come in, you know, those sort of back post goals. I think he'd be perfect for that if we can do a bit from sort of left to right with it. So, yeah, I see him doing a lot of work on the right-hand side, but I think those combinations down the right are going to be really intriguing, and it's going to be really intriguing if we bring someone like Pavard in, who's normally a right-back, for example.
Yeah, I'm very, you know, the first thing to point out when we always think about, you know, the Salah replacement is that most sides don't have the highest player and the most likely goal scorer and the most dangerous threat play off a flank. Most sides have that player play the number nine position. That's where, you know, the team that's just won the treble have got this fella who plays number nine, who's like a robot, he's that good. And I think we always get stuck sort of thinking, well, could he do that or could he have that sort of return? Shapes change. I mean, you know, we're literally talking here about doing something around a change of shape, and attack and emphases change as well. And I think even in this shape, you know, and that's, again, one of the reasons why I am really excited by Szoboszlai. I've lost how to do it. I could say it all morning this morning. It's ridiculous, this. I hear different pronunciations and my head goes west. But even this morning, sorry, even, you know, how I think he gets more out of Salah. Salah was becoming, at times, the ball wasn't Konate to Trent. The ball was Konate to Salah. Salah was coming deeper again. This idea of it not being as symmetrical or what you'd expect. Salah comes down deeper. So then the idea that if Salah comes deeper, the fella who runs into his space is an attacking midfielder winger, not a footballer who we all agree should be getting most of his games as Liverpool's second choice number six. You'd already feel like, well, that's better. That's an improvement. This lad who can come in and beat a man and find the top corner from 20 yards, that's more to worry about. So now Salah's got a little bit more space looking around going, this is great. I can play more. I can pick me pass more. I can be more involved in these areas. You know, this is going to change, and the nature of Salah as a player is going to change as well.
You know, I think there's a lot in this, and I think having this sign and not be one where you're looking at him going, is he a six, is he an eight, which you can still do with McAllister. I think it is good that it's someone you're looking at going, is he an eight, is he a 10, is he a wide player? I think that's so much more important for this profile of player than the is he a six, is he an eight sort of style that a lot of the other ones we've been linked with is. That's why I'm so excited about it, because I think it unlocks so many other things around the pitch. I think it makes Gakpo make more sense. Gakpo can drop into that area. He can go number nine. Or Salah can go number nine. He goes there. Gakpo drops in, and suddenly you've got this carousel of movements, and the opposition are going, well, who do we look after? Because we can't pass anyone on. And you don't want to be, you know, in the way in which there is a, and again, if it always feels like you're really talking him down, you just let towards the end of the season, we're just letting Henderson go. Let him go. Don't worry about him. He's a problem in 2 minutes' time.
Do you know, I've watched bits of him, obviously in the clips. We haven't seen him week in, week out. But I sort of recognise in him a bit, and might wind some people up, the player that Chelsea thought they were getting with Kai Havertz, to some extent, genuinely able to play on form anywhere across the front three, impossible to label and pin down. It just seems, I'm going with body shape, physicality, technique on the ball, can play, could look a central striker.
Well, to be fair, Rob, what I would say is that Havertz impressed massively playing in that league for a side like Leverkusen, who were around that level. And this is why, you know, these things can go wrong, but it's not like we're always going to get them right. Also, you know, I feel as though his Liverpool career is now slightly underrated, but we got Naby Keita from this club. It's worth bearing that in mind as well. You know, these things are not always going to go perfectly, but the thing I keep coming back to is this idea of what's the profile? Does the profile fit? Is the profile right? And I really do feel as though, you know, when I'm looking down those boxes and looking at the metrics and looking at the bits and pieces and looking at the numbers, I just repeatedly keep going, yep, that's a tick, that's a tick, that's a tick, that's a tick. Down to, and it is the last thing on the list I hasten to add, is height.
More so than Mount. More so, I think there'd be much more excitement about Mount from many, and I think wrongly, he's much more suited to that specific role than a lot of the other players out there.
Do you know what other box he ticks if you watch all his YouTubes? He's a hell of a set-piece player. And you know, those who know him say he's got the best right foot in Europe, rather. It's hyperbole, obviously, but actually watch his set-pieces from out wide. Watch his corners, his free kicks. I mean, it shows why we had maybe dropped our interest in James Ward-Prowse, Sean.
Could well, whether he's getting the ball off Trent, and who in the world could get pens off Salah? I'm not sure even Phil Neal could get pens off Salah. I mean, Rob, what are your thoughts in terms of other business? Because what I was thinking is, I think people aren't thinking enough about Klopp doing a bit of 4-4-2, because people keep talking about the six. We've got a lot of centre midfielders that would be all right in a two-man pivot.
Yeah.
Like you put Thiago with Fabinho, is that big a deal? If you put McAllister with Thiago against weaker opposition, is that big a deal? If you haven't got Trent and you're not moving Trent into that role, maybe.
Play 4-4-2.
And Diaz looks comfortable left midfield.
Looks perfect left midfield.
More so than left winger.
As does Jones, I'd add.
Yeah, and if you haven't got Salah, you've got Jota would prefer to play up front with someone else or someone in behind him. Nunes would like to play up front with someone in behind him. Gakpo might like to play with someone in front of him. I think there's a lot more flexibility for 4-4-2 moving forwards than what we saw. I mean, how important do you think Robert is to get a six that replaces Fabinho?
That's a good question. I suppose if one came in, I'd be delighted, but I'd get it. If you'd asked me 6 months ago, 5 months ago, before I saw the run-in and the box formation, then I'd gone, that is the number one position. We have to find somebody who can get towards matching peak Fabinho. Now, you look at most of our options being, as you've just elucidated very well, around double pivot. So Thuram, some people are confused by, is he an attacking player? Is he a defensive player? Well, France have been using left side as a double pivot in the under-21s. His goal stats show he's got one goal last season. He isn't an out-and-out attacking player. He may get you up the pitch into attacking phases of play, but he isn't an attacking player. But he also isn't a dedicated six. The only dedicated six we've been linked to is Romeo Lavia, and I think he's down the pecking order in what we want. This is what I'm saying. You can see the box is what's being bought for. And in theory, if all your signings work out in Jurgen Klopp's fantasy, by the end of the season, he's picking Thuram and Trent as his double sixes, and he's picking McAllister and Szoboszlai possibly as his fantasy number eights, dropping in other good players to rotate. So that's the shape of things to come, I think.
There we are.
I think we're just about done here. We're not inserting. We're not doing any more admin. We're saying a fond farewell.
People should, though, subscribe to the Anfield Wrap and enjoy all the fantastic content that's on there, Rob. Would you agree?
Oh, I heartily agree. And look forward to future live shows, as you told us about earlier. But I wish we could play some music to see out this very last Anfield Wrap live. But I hope you've enjoyed this, another taster of the gutter. I'm going to have to say thank you to Sean. Thank you to Dan. And thank you to Neil. thanks to all of you for tuning in. Sports Social Podcast Network.